not Swiss, that's the problem.
As good as we are. So we're on page four, number 15, the third canon is the canon of relevance. The canons of selection and operations are both concerned with the elementary fact that the empirical inquirer is out to understand not what one may imagine, but what one actually sees or has in some sensible apprehension. The canon of relevance states the type of understanding that is proper to empirical science. And he says, pure science aims immediately at reaching the imminent intelligibility of data, leaves to applied science the categories of final, material, instrumental, and efficient causality. And again, the inner constituents, on page four, number 15, the inner constituents of science itself lie in the intelligibility immanent in the data of sense. The intelligibility immanent in the data of sense resides for science in the relations of things not to our senses but to one another. This intelligibility is hypothetical, it's a possibility, it's what could be the relevant correlation, function, law. Hence it must be verified, and even then it is verified possibility. It is a species of formal causality, a technical term that has long existed but also has long been misunderstood.
Okay.
So those names of the different causalities, that's Aristotle's division of causes, efficient, final, material, formal, instrumental. And basically, it's what science is interested in is what Aristotle called formal causality, or a species of formal causality, namely the immanent intelligibility, the intelligibility that resides in the data, not the intelligibility of who made it, or what's it made for, or what's it made out of, but rather what is it? Formal intelligibility. That will come up later on when the notion of form becomes an explicit metaphysical term. And Lonergan will identify form as a metaphysical element with the intelligibility that is known in the relations, when we know the relations of things to one another. So he will correlate the traditional metaphysical notion of form is what he's talking about right here, the intelligibility imminent in the data. Form will become that. It's more complicated than that. There are two kinds of form, central and conjugate form. It's enough to at least enable us to anticipate where he's going with this. 16, the fourth canon is the canon of parsimony. In other words, the empirical investigator may add to the data of experience only the laws verified in the data. What if one goes beyond that, one's going beyond science. It's very possible for someone like Alfred North Whitehead, for instance, to write Process and Reality, which is a philosophical worldview that is influenced by his work as a mathematician and a scientist. But he's very clear in his own mind that that is not empirical science. It's philosophy. It is going beyond the laws verified in the data, and he's using it now to expand on that and to present a philosophical worldview. But if it's science, then science itself can add to the data of experience only the laws verified in the data. One must content oneself with the laws and systems of laws characterized generally by their verifiability. And the difficulty lies in knowing exactly what you know and what you do not know. Same difficulty that Socrates had in trying to make other people see that it was a real difficulty. At the most elementary level, though, one cannot scientifically affirm statements that are not verified or that cannot be verified. Now, here's where we go into some important notions. This is why I skipped the expansion on the canon of observations, because those things are not as important as this. Some important notions and terms are introduced at this point. The explication begins from the notion of verification. What is verified? It's formulations, all right? You arrive at a certain formulation. The distance is proportional to the time squared. The formula is more complicated than that. But you arrive at some kind of a formulation like that, and then you verify it through further experimentation. formulations state either the relations of things to our senses or the relations of things to one another. Now, there are two terms here that we have to get some kind of a hold on at this point, experiential conjugates and pure or explanatory conjugates. The terms of formulations that state the relations of things to our senses are called experiential conjugates. Red, as seen, is an experiential conjugate. Solid, as touched, is an experiential conjugate. Correlatives, whose meaning is expressed by appealing to the content of some human experience. Colors as seen, sounds as heard, heat as felt, forced as experienced, and so on. Clearly, these can be verified. And so they satisfy the canon of parsimony. But there are also formulations that state the relations of things to one another. And the terms of such formulations are called pure or explanatory conjugates. These are correlatives defined implicitly by empirically established correlations, functions, laws, theories, systems. So, examples. Mass. Masses are the correlatives implicit in Newton's law of inverse squares. Or again, mass in 20th century physics is defined in relation to the speed of light and energy. In Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared. Mass is the m there. And it is defined in relation to the speed of light and energy. So if the conjugate means correlation. Conjugate is the word that comes from the Latin word for being joined to, conjugate. Okay? We use the same in speaking of conjugal relations, for instance. Well, he's talking about something a little different here from conjugal relations, but it's a conjugate. The term, the root of the term is the same thing. Okay, conjugate. Relations. So red as seen, all right, relation of things to my senses, and M, mass, related to the speed of light and energy. Okay? It's a conjugate in the sense that it's defined in terms of its relations. We only know what it is in terms of its relations to other things. Heat, now as an explanatory conjugate, not as boy, it's hot in this room, but rather heat as an explanatory conjugate is defined implicitly by the first law of thermodynamics. If the equations can be established empirically, then the pure conjugates satisfy the canon of parsimony. Since by definition, pure conjugates mean no more than necessarily is implicit in the meaning of such verified equations. This is going to be important in a number of ways here. The fact that the experiential conjugates can be verified means that if they can be verified, then they can be accepted, all right? That you don't have to say, as post-Galilean science said, that they have to be reduced. They're merely subjective, and they have to be reduced to matter in motion. Red, as seen, can be affirmed. And if it can be affirmed, then you're saying something about what probably is. But you're saying about it in terms of its relations to our senses. Wavelengths of light could be explaining the same thing in terms of explanatory conjugates. But the verification in both cases means that true judgments can be made in both instances. So in general, then, think of conjugate as correlative, so that a color is correlative to seeing, a sound to hearing, mass to energy and the speed of light, etc. Every term is in a set of relations. The whole universe is a set of terms and relations. And the type of relations that govern the use of the term determines whether the term is an experiential or an explanatory conjugate. And then there will be a difference in the mode of verifying the conjugates. An experiential conjugate is verified through experience. It's the content of experience, seeing red, or a correlative to such a content, red as seen, or whatever, derivative. Pure conjugate is not the content of experience. No one experiences mass as it's understood in the formula E equals mc squared, or the actual or potential correlative of such a content. Again, one might see a series of extensions, an and alongside each a yardstick, but one will arrive at a continuous function as the result of a number of series of measurements and correlations along with the leap of insight, and that's where you know the pure conjugate in the continuous function. Pure conjugates are the minimal correlatives implicit in such functions, and their verification finds its ground not in experience as such, but only in the combinations of combinations and combinations of experiences that are involved in moving away from the median experience into the scientific experimentation and so on that leads to the establishment and verification of these laws. Okay, so is that difference clear? That's all that I need to have. Experiential conjugates, explanatory conjugates. They're both valid if they can be verified. Read as seen can be verified, and it's the starting point for optics, a branch of physics. But it's experiential. But the wavelengths of light that are known in optics get you into the realm of explanatory conjugates in relation to things that you know. Cognitional theory, what he's doing in this book, is a form of explanation. It's relating things to one another. It's relating to one another the operations that are involved in our knowing. But it correlates not contents, but acts. And here we're back to Nadia's question about the veil of consciousness. So cognitional theory is correlating, relating to one another, explaining human knowing by relating to one another the acts that are involved in human knowing. It's correlating. So on page 104, either one's terms are experiential conjugates, read as seen, or they're pure conjugates based on combining contents alone, wavelengths of light, or finally, they're a special case of pure conjugates based on combining acts alone, sense, now being related to question, being related to insight, being related to concept, further question, and so on. These take on a new meaning in terms of terms implicitly defined by their relations to one another. So physicists move easily and, as it were, unconsciously back and forth between the first two, between red as seen and wavelengths of light. They're going back and forth all the time between the two. The book Insight is concerned with moving from experiential conjugates to explanatory conjugates in the realm of acts. So the experience of sensation, the experience of inquiry, the experience of insight, the experience of concept, that's experiential conjugates. But then when you start relating those to one another, you're into the explanatory. And that's what this book is doing. So it's a scientific movement from all of these operations as experienced to all of these operations as understood in their relations to one another. So he's claiming here to be providing a form of scientific investigation based on the data of consciousness and involving the data of consciousness. That clear? Got that difference between experiential, explanatory, and then with regard to data of sense and with regard to data of consciousness. Okay. Next, besides the conjugates, pure and experiential, there are events, happenings, occurrences. The law of nature, which would be known through experiential explanatory conjugates, is one thing, but the event of its illustration is another. It's a happening. Events are subject to laws of a different type, namely statistical laws, because they happen every so often. Okay? Events, this is another, all right, this is another tough and then very important point here. Events stand to conjugates as questions for reflection stand to questions for intelligence. If we get that, then we've got a big step in this cognitional theory. You've got the beginning of grasping one of the main points of it. So, questions for intelligence. Ask such things as what? Why? How? And then questions for
reflection ask, is it so? Is it true? Now, questions for reflection have to do with the answers to questions for intelligence. What is it? In response to that, for instance, what is a free fall? You come up with the formula, Galileo's formula for the free fall. What is it? But then, is it true? You experiment and you find out, well, it does seem to hold. So with further experimentation and so probably yes. Now, one of the differences between these two kinds of questions is that questions for reflection can be answered yes or no. Is it? Is it so? Is it true? Yes or no? It can be answered yes or no. But what is a free fall? Yes. That doesn't make any sense. You can't answer yes to questions for intelligence. You have to give some kind of content in terms of conjugate to the question for intelligence. Okay, so you've got questions for intelligence. What is it? Why does this happen? How is it that this happens? You have to explain, you have to answer those questions in terms of conjugates with content, either explanatory conjugates or experiential conjugates. But then, is that so? Which is a question that is asked with regard to your answer to this, is answered yes or no. Okay. What you know in these questions, in science at least, are events. Events are known when you answer yes or no to the is it so? Is it true? Does this happen? Yes or no? So an event stands to a conjugate as a question for reflection stands to a question for intelligence. You do the experimentation with regard to the law of falling bodies, correlating distance and time, and you find that it's so, and it happens. Okay, it's the event. Yes, it happens. You know that you know it in an event. You verify it in an event. So questions for intelligence, which lead to knowledge of conjugates, are questions that cannot be answered yes or no. What is the correlation? What is the function? Are questions that cannot be answered yes or no. They have to be answered both in science, many times they're answered in some mathematical formulation. Questions for reflection are questions that can be answered yes or no. For every question, for every answer to a question for intelligence, there is a corresponding question for reflection. This is Lonergan's cognitional theory now given to you in one of the most important points of it. For every answer to a question for intelligence, there is a corresponding question for reflection. Is it so? Is that really true? And all questions for reflection have the peculiarity that they can be answered appropriately simply by saying either yes or no. If I ask what a body is, I can also ask whether there are bodies. If I ask how bodies fall, question for intelligence, I can also ask whether they fall. If I ask how they would fall in a vacuum, I can also ask whether they ever fall in a vacuum. Whether they fall in a vacuum according to the law that I've arrived at or the correlation that I've arrived at, and so on. Generally, the enunciation of every law can be followed by the question for a reflection that asks whether the law is verified. And the definition of every term can be followed by the question for a reflection whether the defined exists or occurs. Inversely, whenever one asserts verification or existence or occurrence, one may be asked what is verified, what exists, what occurs. So questions for intelligence and questions for reflection are universally concomitant and complementary. These will eventually fold out into the two levels of understanding. Questions for intelligence and judgment. Questions for reflection. Anticipating now or introducing that distinction between understanding and judgment for the first time in the book. What is it? Question for understanding or intelligence. Is it? Is that so? Is that true? Question for judgment. Question for reflection, leading to judgment, yes or no. The Thomist terms, essence and existence. What is it? Is it? But grounded, the Thomist distinction of essence and existence, grounded now in cognitional operations. There is a parallel concomitance and complementarity between conjugates and events. Without events, conjugates can be neither discovered nor verified. Things have to happen before you can figure out what happens. But without conjugates, events can be neither distinguished nor related. It's just one great big happening, whether everybody's high on marijuana or something. Big happening. Such is the elementary scheme which can be grasped by insight what is meant by the term event. And formulations that concern events also satisfy the canon of parsimony. It happens so many times. Now that, of course, is not a yes or no, but it's things that can be answered yes or no that happen so many times. It's events. So statistical laws formulate the answer to the question, how often, which is a question for intelligence, but it has to do with how often do these things that can be verified happen? How often do these events happen? Again, the parallel, the concomitance of the two types of questions. Fifth canon, complete explanation. Ultimately, science, this is what science wants anyway, must account for all data. And the account must be scientific. Any scientist that would not subscribe to that would not be accepted by his or her peers as a very intelligent or a very authentic scientific inquirer. There are things that are left out and they say, well, who cares about that? Well, no, that's not the scientific intelligence. The goal of empirical method as a common enterprise, no one scientist is ever going to get this, but as a community enterprise, the goal is commonly stated to be the complete explanation of all phenomena or data. There is a specific implication to this that has something to do with the movement, the difference between Galileo and Einstein. The old philosophic opinion, which is definitely in Galileo, that extension is a real and objective primary quality, extension in space, cannot dispense one from the task of determining empirically the correct geometry experienced extensions and durations. To build up the whole thing is going to take this number 21 and 22 together, so be patient, bear with me as I go through this. Galileo's distinction of secondary and primary qualities, and his notion that scientific progress lies in the reduction of the merely apparent secondary qualities to their real and objective source, and the mathematical dimensions of matter in motion, here gives way to the movement from experiential to pure conjugate. So the difference then between Galileo and what science in the 20th century was doing, or from description to explanation. For Lonergan, you see description and explanation are both valid knowing. Galileo, color is seen as merely subjective. The only real knowing is the knowing that knows it in terms of its mathematical dimensions of matter and motion. Secondary qualities were merely subjective appearances that arise in an animal's senses as a result of the action of the primary qualities. Color is seen, sounds is heard, heat is felt, tickling is experienced, etc. Primary qualities were the mathematical dimensions of the real and objective of matter and motion. That's what's really out there. While I would place, scientific progress in the movement from experiential to pure conjugates, both of which know what is real. Galileo placed it in the reduction of what he regarded as merely apparent secondary qualities to their real and objective source in primary qualities. So there's a real difference there.
color as seen for Galileo was merely subjective. The judgment, this is red, if it's verified, is a true judgment for Lonergan and knows reality. This affects especially space and time as far as science is concerned. For Galileo, space and time are primary qualities, whereas for Lonergan, there's the same distinction between extension and duration as experienced and as pure consciousness as there is between two formulations of colors, sound, or heat, or electric phenomena. So the space-time of relativity stands to the extensions and durations of experience in exactly the same relations as wavelengths of light stand to experiences of color, as longitudinal waves in the air stand to experience of sound, as the type of energy defined by the first law of thermodynamics stands to experiences of heat, etc. As experiential conjugates, extensions and durations are defined as correlatives to certain familiar experiences within our elements within our experience. I mean, I can just say, well, this is longer than this. That's extension as experience compared to another extension. As pure conjugates, however, they're defined implicitly by the postulate that the principles of physics are invariant under inertial or generally under continuous transformations. The point being then that science must determine empirically the correct geometry of experienced extensions and durations. So experience, extension and duration are no more pure as experienced than color as experienced. And in each case, scientific movement is to move from what's experienced to what is known in terms of relationship to one another. All data are to be explained, including extensions and durations. Moreover, since experiential conjugates can be verified, Galileo's repudiation of them as mere appearance is a blunder. Nor did he base his affirmation of the reality and objectivity of primary qualities on a claim that they could be verified. That wasn't the basis for it. And so that claim was extra scientific. It's ironic, you know, that the church goes after Galileo for his real discovery. And in fact, there is something else, scientifically, it didn't have anything to do with faith or anything like that, but where he really was erroneous. So the same considerations affect local movement. It has a preliminary definition in terms of experiential conjugates and an explanatory definition in terms of pure conjugates. The preliminary definition of movement as related to us determines a spatial trajectory and then correlates points on the path with instants of time. For instance, you're looking out your window and you see somebody crossing the street. Well, you see at once the whole distance, but you apprehend the duration of the movement as concomitant with the duration of your watching. Okay, that's time and space as experience. But the explanatory definition conceives of velocity not as a function of three dimensions with time as a parameter, but as a function of four dimensions, of which three are spatial and the fourth temporal. And that's the geometry of experience, extensions, and durations. And that's where the scientific knowledge of space and time comes in, those formulations. Okay, up to there. Well, the rest of it is on the canon of empirical residues, and I'm really just not intending to go too much into that. So I'm wondering whether or not there's anything in there that I need to take. I'm going to let it go, if you don't mind, because I think we've done enough on the statistical to let it be. And I think what we'll do is just see if there are any questions or anything you want to discuss. Yes, Mark, just
quickly. When you, on the first page, really,
yes.
You talked about the fruitful unfolding of the heuristic structures.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean?
Okay.
Fruitful unfolding.
The heuristic structure is the structure of the process that you follow as you move toward
the goal that you want to get to. So what do you want? You want to know, for instance, whether there's a correlation between distance and time as bodies fall, the law of falling bodies. And that was Galileo wanted to know, what is the law that attains there? So he wants to know that. Well, then there's a certain set of criteria that that function has to meet, okay? And whatever they might happen to be under the circumstances, whatever it is that you want to know. You work out what are the criteria that have to be satisfied by the answer before I'll be satisfied with the answer. And you work as much of that out as possible, and then you have to work that out so that you can set up your experiments in a way that will be fruitful, that will lead to where you want to go. And that's that's an instance of the fruitful unfolding of the heuristic structure. Your experiments have got to be set up so that they lead to where you want to go. And you do that by working out and eliminating the irrelevant as much as possible from your experiments so that you can focus on the issue. And then the heuristic structure can unfold fruitfully, and the fruitful unfolding of it means that you get to where you want it to go in the first place. Or let X be the unknown number, then you work out the characteristics that X must satisfy, and you eliminate everything else from consideration. And the fruitful unfolding of the algebraic problem, of the heuristic structure in the algebraic problem, is correlative with, well, did you get the answer? If you got the answer, it's fruitful. If you didn't, you better go back and do some work.
But that you have the answer isn't necessarily an insight.
It is a function of an insight. It is. It is. Aristotle said bodies fell according to their weight. And Galileo said, I ain't got a problem. I'm not sure that's true. There's something else involved. So that's the beginning of an insight. The beginning of the insight for him is that the understanding that is a function of the measurable aspects. So, and what are the measurable aspects in those particular instances? Distance and time. That's what you can measure. And somehow, he begins by saying that there's some kind let's see, is there some kind of correlation between these two measurable aspects? That's the beginning of his insight. And that's what enables the process to go forward. He tests it, and he finds that in fact it works, and it works in a particular way. It's not an inverse relationship, it's a direct relationship, or whatever. You know, it can be whatever. It can be one half, or whatever. But the initial insight is there's some correlation between the measurable aspects. He doesn't know right away exactly what it is. He's got to experiment before he can formulate it. But insight is grasping the connections. At the beginning of that, when he says that there's some relation between the two. Now, if he tests it and finds there's no relation between the two, then that's an insight that was one of those dime a dozen insights. You know? And you've got to start all over again. So insight is not necessarily true. Insight is the answer to a question for intelligence. And after that comes the question for reflection. Is it true? And you've got to do further experimentation or whatever to verify that it is. What else can I say about that? These are scientific examples. There can be insights into concrete situations that when you size up a situation. And that's an insight. Sizing up a situation is an insight. You size up your faculty. You size up, how am I going to get by in this course? You size it up. That's an insight. The answer to that question is an insight.
But then there's the further question, is that really gonna work? The question that, to which the answer is yes or no. But sizing up a concrete situation, or, you know, you'll walk into somebody's office and they're scowling, and you have the insight, well, maybe it's better that I come back another day. That's an insight into sizing up the situation. Maybe this isn't the time to ask the question. That's sizing up the concrete situation.
How about getting a jolt?
Getting a jolt is an answer. Getting the point of a jolt is an answer.
Yeah, but there's
these
isolated bits of information.
And when someone says, I don't get it, it means that they didn't get it. Well, no, that's okay.
Not getting a joke is particularly obvious because there's no change.
You know, there are sometimes we all have that experience. You know.
Oh, right. I mean, it, yeah. Get it.
Yeah, but it is
not
an insight.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did I
answer
your question? Did I come anywhere near?
Yeah, I just, as a creative work, some kind of tension. What was the tension that he described in the first chapter?
Creative tension.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. The tension required.
Tension.
Okay, let's do this, Robin.
When you were answering Nadia before, I thought, did you say that data of consciousness include data of sense? You didn't say that.
I mean, what I meant by that is that, that certainly the operations of sense, seeing, hearing,
right, yeah.
are data
okay,
of consciousness
yeah,
as
yeah.
well. That's what I meant to say.
So the data of sense is the brownness of the table and the hardness,
okay.
But the data of
consciousness
is the feeling and the seeing. Yeah.
The operation of seeing. That's what I meant.
Yeah. So one's not a subset of the other, but the...
Pardon me?
One's not a subset of the other.
No, I didn't.
Quite, just again.
I think I did sort of glibly suggest that there might be, that you're qualifying on the way, but this helps it. It's the operation that is the labor of consciousness.
Yeah. The acts.
You don't see the act of seeing, but you see what's seen. But you experience the act of seeing. So that's helpful. Sometimes. Go over to the gallery to your brain. Nadia, is that okay for you? Or does that make it?
But on the other hand, I guess my whole point is that you cannot see anything without the act of seeing.
Right?
That
certainly is true.
Exactly. So the point is that it has to be also a date of consciousness, and you answered that question before. So for me it was clear before.
Okay. Well, you're also conscious of what is seen, but so in that sense, what is strictly the datum of consciousness there is the act of seeing.
Which is the perception.
Whatever.
Perceiving.
Perceiving. Yeah. Yeah. Perceiving. John.
When I was a kid, my two brothers, older than me, were studying science, and they used to insist that this table doesn't really exist, it's the molecules that make it up. Would it be fair to say I was philosophically abused?
So Eddington's two tables, that's exactly the problem that Eddington presents in the first few pages of his book on the nature of the physical world. But now, for Galileo, what your brothers were saying is what Galileo would say. For Lonergan, they're both real, because they can both be real. And that's, for him, the criterion of the real is the verified. So they're both real. And they're both the same table. They're the same table, no difference.
But is there a qualitative difference in terms of that verification? In the sense that, I guess what I'm saying is one more true than the other.
No. One's descriptive and one's explanation. They're both knowing.
Oh, okay.
One is descriptive knowing, the other is explanatory.
Okay.
One, the table is, the table that, that his brothers told him wasn't real is not the table as scientifically known. It isn't. But it is the table that is known in common sense. And common sense is known. Common sense is descriptive knowledge. It's knowing things in their relations to us. It's precisely what we mean by common sense.
Okay. I guess now I got it.
Yeah.
Read.
And these things that he's it'll build. I mean, well, after next week we'll go into two chapters on common sense, which is knowing things in their relations to us, like the table as, you know, as that you use to dress things on and eat on and so on. That's the table in common sense.
And I guess my personal bias would be in line to what your brothers were saying, in the sense that I always tend, I guess, kind of distrust that relation to ourselves. But that is also a truth. It's not just the relations of objects amongst themselves
no.
that is true. That is also a truth.
And
because we are objects
yeah,
ourselves.
Yeah, Lonergan's, the two chapters on common sense will end with a critique of common sense, because common sense is not competent in a lot of areas where it tends to try to be competent. So there's a general bias of common sense against theory, against long-range issues, against ultimate questions, and that can be disastrous in setting up the society, for instance. If the realm of culture and science and philosophy is neglected in the establishment of the society, and the values that are pursued in those disciplines and so on are regarded as being ivory tower eggheads, you know, and you just push them off into a corner, and you don't listen to your philosophers, and you don't listen to Eric Vogelin asks, why are there some insights that are known only by the philosophers and the saints? And we never learn them. We never learn from them. Why? It's this general bias of common sense against the kinds of issues that philosophers and saints are concerned with. Learning their lessons over and over and over.
So John's abusive brothers were not following the canon of selection, they were going beyond the realm of science.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were being indoctrinated by their professors.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. Thank you. So next week will be, I've got you scheduled for chapters 4 and 5. I'm going to say about 10 minutes worth on chapter 5, because it's all I'm capable of in chapter 5, on space and time. So I'm not going to go into rods and clocks, a section on rods and clocks.
Wait for the album to come out.
Huh?
Wait for the album
yeah,
to come out.
Yeah,
Greg, yeah, leave that to Greg. Yeah.
Greg says that rods and clocks would make a good name for a rock band. So.
I have another real question,
yes.
Just two trivial clocks now. Why does Lonergan choose to use American instead of Canadian?
That was an editorial decision.
There was an editorial decision.
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
So the manuscripts, did he write in Canadian or in American?
Yeah, this manuscript in Canadian. Later on, he moved to American spelling.
The only thing I can think of is the new revised standard. I also noticed that the new revised Bible number is also American spelling. And this is the new revised standard. So it's being used throughout the world, not just having it, including Canada. Do not use American. So I'm curious why then would you want to choose? Because it's a Canadian philosopher. So having Canadian philosophers write in American English is awesome.
He was the main force behind that. I mean, I'm Canadian now, but I say by the chance of the States, he's pro himself as a Canadian.
I will, huh?